Did everybody get that number? I want you to know that we're going to have a major Congress. Our people are moving to the mics if they're any in June, called the Moral Poverty Action Congress. I'd love for you to come. We also have a Poor People's Campaign National Call for Moral Revival State Coordinating Committee in 30 states now. Kansas is one of them. We're reviving it. I certainly hope that you all will consider young folk being a part of it. And then on June of 2024, actually before then, we're going to start having actions at state capitals around this country. It may mean nonviolent, civil disobedience. Not violent. We're not a insurrection. We're a resurrection. But we cannot allow 700 people dying a day from poverty go ignored and unseen and unheard. And then in June of 2024, we had in June 18th of this past year a mass Poor People's Low Wage Workers Assembly Moral March from Washington to the polls, and over 100,000 people showed up, millions online. We then touched more than 8 million poor and low-wealth voters who had not voted before. And some of the victories and things that you've seen are because those people decided to turn out. But it's still not enough, because we still have too much gradualism. And some things we've been waiting on, we've been waiting on them for 100 years. Teddy Roosevelt wanted health care for everybody in 1912 in his bull speech. You know, I see the political scientists sitting down there. And so this stuff is too far overdue, y'all. And so in June of 2024, we're going to have another mass Poor People's Low Wage Workers Assembly, but it's going to be more than just a day. People are going to come from everywhere. We're going to engage. We've said to the nation, we don't see some change within the next few months. We have no option but in love to stand up. We're not violent people. And if you believe this, if you're young, if you want to step in the movement of your day, your parents had the movement of their day, but if you want to have the movement, and some of your parents can have it twice, this is the time. And I want to invite you, hook up with that number. Go to Repairs of the Breach. Get the weekly. Check everything I said, footnote it, tear it apart. I don't care. Because I know at the end of the day what you're going to find is we got some lies that have to be undone. The lie of scarcity, that we don't have enough. It's a lie. The lie that we don't know what to do to fix these problems. Yes, we do. You don't have to have a man saying, my pensions were stolen, I'm a coal miner, I got black lung disease and can't get treated for it because some politician voted that a company could take over the company without having to carry my health care and my pension. That doesn't have to exist. But the greatest problem we have is moral consciousness. There's not enough people willing to sit long enough and hear how bad it is, to see the faces of the people, and then to be willing to join in a movement that says we won't be silent or unseen anymore. So I want to invite you, please go to that number, and I hope you will join us. Is there someone at the mic? I saw somebody go to the mic. Can someone move this out of the way so I can see? Yes, sir.
Good evening. First of all, just thank you for coming out and sharing your message.
Thank you, my friend.
Truly a blessing. My question to you is, how would you go about having a conversation with someone who probably doesn't see the finances as an issue with the problems that we're having in our country?
Yeah, that's always a powerful question. And one of the things that we're finding in the movement are people who are coming, like there's a lady, it didn't show in this video, who engaged in civil disobedience around healthcare, and she said she was in a wheelchair. And when she came, I said to her, daughter, you don't have to do this. She said, number one, I do have to do it because they need to see who they're hurting. You know. But number two, I'm wealthy. So I have health care. And that's why I can't sit back and watch other people not have it. There's a sense in which we got this moral problem. It's bigger than just policy. It's kind of like a social catastrophe where what's going on is causing people to lose their humanity, right? And we have to help in the recovery of the humanity. And so the second thing is, I always put that price tag, because most people don't know it's costing us $1 trillion a year to keep children poor. You know, the amount of money that's costing. Like, what if you knew that corporations are using your tax dollars to supplement their workers so they don't have to pay them a living wage? What that's called welfare. What they do is they don't pay people a living wage, and then we have to set up welfare program. Now, I'm not anti-welfare program, but I'm saying if people were paid a living wage, they wouldn't need certain things. And four Nobel Peace Prize scientists did a study, and they found out that people were lying to us when they said, if you raise wages, that's going to raise the prices so high. I mean, there are countries where you make $20 an hour flipping hamburgers. Now, part of the reason that doesn't happen in America is because two things get involved in it, race and gender. In other words, as Dr. King once said, and many others have said, if forces that want to keep black wages low end up keeping white wages low too. See, and that's a whole nother discussion for another day. But the level of economic cost, my brother, that we actually pay because of bad policies. I was thinking the other day, when we were in the middle of COVID, Ruth Bader Ginsburg died. Mitch McConnell, and you notice I don't ever call party names, because it really, I don't care. I'm not into which party it is. I'm going to tell you about the action of the person. He was more interested in putting somebody on this Supreme Court seat. He violated his own policy. When the same thing happened when Obama was in office, he said, you can't do it. You got to wait until the next election. He was so interested. He was more interested in putting somebody on that Supreme Court seat than he was keeping people out of caskets. That's how we have to start talking. He had an option. They could pass health care or put somebody in the Supreme Court. They could pass living wages, put somebody in the Supreme Court. He chose to put somebody in the Supreme Court. And if you go look at the person he put on the Supreme Court, 90% of their votes have to do with corporate power. Corporate power. The people he put on the court always vote in favor of the corporations. So what does that mean? That means you then have people on the court who are more interested in allowing corporations to put pornographic sums of money into our political system than they are making sure students don't have debt. You see how it sounds when you put it like that? It did sound crazy. And it is. It's literally, because when you have a heart problem, they tell me that when your heart gets weak, one of the first signs of it is your mind gets weak. You can't think right. You start having all kinds of flashing lights and all kinds of stuff. You can't think right. And so a social heart problem is causing us to think in ways that just don't make any sense. 7 people died from vaping, and we had congressional hearings and presidential level conversation because somebody wanted to protect that industry. 700 people dying from poverty, and we ain't had a damn hearing yet. And that's on top of the thousands of people that were dying every day from COVID. Many of which now we find, do you know there's data out there? My daughter, as I told you, is a public health specialist. She focuses on what's called epidemiology, the study of death. I'm gonna listen, y'all. Some studies say 60% of the people that died in this country didn't have to die. It was policy. Think about that. That's 600,000 plus people. If that doesn't shock us and wake us up, you know, if that doesn't say, regardless of whether you're okay financially or not okay, listen, everybody on the Titanic went down. even though some people were in the poor bunks and some people were in the high class bunk, when the ship went down, I'm telling you, and I believe this, and it scares me to say it, the thing that I fear the most is that what if just 50 million of poor and low wealth people in this country just give up and go to despair, and then they let despair drive them, and they just say it's all screwed up, it ain't gonna never get better. January 6th might look like a birthday party. Because the level of poverty we have in this country is worse than it's ever been, the gaps, even in the Great Depression. And the democracy cannot stand much more of this. I really want you young folks to hear. In fact, let me do it. Let's be honest, because some people, they're like, how many of you in here, honestly, know somebody that's struggling economically? Look. Ain't got a daggone thing to do with race. Look. How many of you in here know somebody that's working hard for less than a living wage? Look. How many of you know somebody in here that worries about going to the doctor because they either don't have health care or the health care they have is underinsured? And I didn't even dare ask, how about right in here? Not just know somebody, you're the somebody. And none of this has to exist. There's a big book coming out, I'll stop, by a sociologist out of Princeton, a friend of mine. You know, I'll take this next lady's question. And it's going to be on the abolition of poverty. Why aren't we talking about ending poverty? Just like we talked about going to the moon or ending cancer. Why? We must start having that conversation. Because you just proved by a raise of a show of hand that everybody is impacted. And I didn't ask one of you all, were you Republican? Were you Democrat? Were you liberal? Were you conservative? I just asked you, how many of y'all know somebody that's struggling and can't meet them? And I don't think if there was 5% of this room that didn't raise their hand, there was 20%. Almost everybody in here raised their hand. Yes, ma'am.
Good evening, Bishop. My name is Deborah Warsham. I'm 7 decades plus, so I'm not a student here.
That's all
but
right.
I thank God that we were open to the community to come and share, and I want to express my gratitude to you for taking the time to come out and share with the young people on today. I follow you on YouTube for Greenleaf Christian Church, and you've been a blessing. I plant seeds so that I can continue to enjoy the blessing. My question is to the young people, if not me, who? And if not now, when? As I said, I'm 70 plus years old, and I've been through the civil rights movement of the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, 2010, because we still are in the movement. But Bishop has done an excellent job in challenging our youth, our young people, our college students to become engaged and to do what we can do to make America better, not only for ourselves, but for our generations that are yet to still come. We don't want our children, your children, that will be here within the next few years to have to go through some of these same kinds of presentations and challenges that we're talking about today. So my question is, Bishop, to you, what can we do as members? Most of us are members or affiliates in some way with the churches, and I'm not really seeing that the churches are doing all they can do to encourage everybody, and particularly our young people, to get actively engaged, and to the other older people that are maybe not able to get out and,
I got it.
But we can support financially if we're able to support the movement. But just particularly to the church, what can we do to be more effective, to make an impact in the lives of our youth?
That's right. Well, let me just say, when I thought about this speech, I did not do it because of young people. I did it, this, as I said, that you've been through much to be called young. There's a line in Wakanda that says you've been, experienced too much to be called a child anymore. And so I actually think we adults have failed young folk. I think that, I think a lot of leadership, people who hold titles, I'm always criticizing and critiquing myself. You know, why is it that we have more members of the Black Caucus than we've had ever in the history of this country? And yet the caucus didn't say, we're not gonna vote for infrastructure until we get a voting rights bill. That's all they had to do. If their 50 members had just said, we're not voting for anything until we get living wages. I'm pretty tough on what we've not done. The majority of the people who are not voting are plus 40. And I think we have to challenge that. I think that this generation, and people were amazed at the recent turnout of the vote, this generation is so hungry for a different kind of politics. They're just so hungry for a different kind of politics. And I find it all over. They have just gotten almost sick of what they see. And they know it doesn't have to be like this. I think even when I go in a crowd like this with young people, because I don't, you know, I could do the rap and the rhyme and the flashy stuff, but I don't know how many times I've come to a room like this and the young folks said, thanks for taking us serious. You know, I didn't come in and do a rap and do a thing and, you know, do some quick, you know, bumper sticker stuff. I'm taking them very serious, intellectually serious, very spiritually serious. When it comes to the church, I think we're in a place just like the prophets were. You know, in the Bible, the prophets only arose when the priests weren't doing their job. And I think that it is a sad commentary that, as I said, the Pew study did a 50,000, they studied 50,000 sermons. 2,000 scriptures in the Bible speak to how you treat the poor. And yet the issue of poverty didn't even come up in 1% of the sermons. So I think that the church has to stop engaging in theological malpractice and get engaged in these issues in the public square. The church has got to stop being isolated. Pulpits need to be on fire just with preaching. You know, Jesus started with the poor. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me to preach good news to the poor. He ended with the poor. When I was hungry, did you feed me? When I was naked, did you clothe me? You know, I never will forget when I was in Congress and we presented a budget before Congress. Poor and low-wealth people, and my colleague, Reverend Dr. Liz Theo Harris, was there, co-chair of the pulpit campaign. And one of the legislators stood up and said, no, he asked for the mic. He said, I'm bothered because at that day we had on stoves that said Jesus was a poor man. He said, I don't like the fact that you're here but saying Jesus was a poor man, because I've been a Christian since I was 8 and I never saw in the Bible where Jesus challenged Caesar. And I said, excuse me? He said, I never seen in the Bible where Jesus challenged Caesar. I said, sir, you just pointed out the problem. Now, it's worse than I thought. I said, did you just identify yourself with Caesar? Then that we really do have a problem. And do you actually believe as a Christian that Jesus was not contrary to Caesar? That's what you've been taught. But that has a long history too. You know, Frederick Douglass said that the slave master religion, he had to denounce it because he loved the religion of Jesus. As you heard me say, that the church had a split long before the country had a split. We need people of faith to be engaged. But in this moment, we need everybody to be engaged. But let me just say this to give you hope. There's a study one time that said, if you can just get 2% of a nation to work together, they can shift the narrative and the consciousness of that nation. Not 20%. God told Isaiah in Isaiah 6 that just 10% of the nation doing the right thing would change the nation. I want you all to hear this. All the people we read about in history were in the minority. It wasn't like everybody marched. When everybody tell you, when folks around tell you, I was there with Dr. King, hush. Because if everybody said they were there, it would have been more than 250,000 people at the March on Washington. Because there were that many people in Washington, D.C. So just hush. Everybody was not there. The majority of the people were not there. The majority of the preachers were not there. Dr. King was put out of his own denomination, put out of the Baptist Church. So I don't want us to live in a need for a majority. What God said to Ezekiel is, if I can find one person. What the scriptures say, the ancient psalmist, the stone that the builders reject. What has to happen is the rejected people have to come together. If you, those have been rejected because of the poverty, rejected because of race, rejected because of your sexuality, that's the coming together. And if a remnant comes together, Harriet Tubman got 700 slaves out of slavery. She didn't have Twitter. She didn't have Instagram. She didn't have none of that. My point is, we need a committed group of people. Don't ever live in the false. It was not thousands of people that led the march from across the Edmund Pettus Bridge. It was probably 400. Now, in the end, it was 25,000 people. But I'm talking about who were beaten, who did it, right? It's never been. I would dare you right here at this school, last thing I'll say. I wish some students right here on this campus would get together and look at who got elected from in this state to the Senate, who got elected in this state to the Congress, and then look at how many votes they won by and how many people didn't vote. And you probably will find that if just college students, if just 20-30% of college students would come together around an aggressive agenda, some of the folk who are sitting in office as your senators and others, they wouldn't sit there. There's more power out here available. And so that's my message. The church needs to do what the church has been called to do by its founder. Care for the poor and the least of these, or either take the signs down. Don't call it church, call it club. Call it something, but don't call it church. And then we need everybody. And the truth of the matter is, it's going to be just like in every other generation, it's going to be the conscientiousness of this generation that is going to change. They're not going to do it like we do it, though, did it? But I believe that this generation is poised. And that's why what I see my job oftentimes is, if folk hear the diagnosis, they'll seek the cure. So that's why I don't come to be cute. I don't come to play. I come to take you seriously, and I come to ask you, are you willing to let things stay where 140 million people, many of are you and people you know, live in poverty, low wealth, and doesn't have to be? Are you willing to allow this country to continue to deny 87 million people health insurance, either be uninsured or underinsured? Are you going to allow this country to have the kind of voter suppression we've seen that we thought we had done away with? Are you going to let governors and House people talk about divorcing the country and destroying people's history and not deal with this issue? It's a question of your heart. And if you answer the question that is wrong and you know about it, then that means you are being called to join, not 20 years from now, but right now. And I'm telling you, a lot of the problems we have seen, and I don't care who you voted for, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm just saying, everybody talking about Trump. Well, it was 80,000 votes. At some point, you got to turn that question over and say, wait a minute. If the man got in by 80,000 votes in three states and 57 million people stayed home, then maybe we need to get off him and start focusing on us. My grandma used to say like this, what is us going to do?
Yeah.